Hello, you're listening to Spoiler
Filled.
Film.
Conversation.
Hooray!
Yay! I don't even know why I'm cheering. I didn't like this movie that much.
Oh, that's a bit
Oh,
already out the door with I didn't like it that much. It's not a bad film. You
wow.
should have been saying that at Xanadu.
I didn't give Xanadu that much ump.
Okay. Well, Abby has already spoilt her own conversation we're about to have. But for this spoiler-filled film conversation, hooray, I'm Richard Nicholas. I am Richard Nicholas every time, but I'm Richard Nicholas, hello. With me for the podcast is Jamie Thomas.
Hello.
I did not expect that, and yet should have. And Abigail Bane.
Hello.
Oh, you should have gone for a kind of, Clifton-style Mah! Noise. Mah!
Yeah, that I can do.
Hello. I hope you like podcasts about Man on the Moon, because that is what is happening right now. It was Jamie's choice of film this week, so I will ask Jamie to tell us the details of what film, give us the, you do the bit, the
Do the
IMDb
bit.
thing, read it out.
Okay. Man on the Moon is from 1999, directed by is it Milos or Milosh Forman?
It sounds better, Milosh, because it sounds like
I
slush.
depends.
Milosh.
I've heard it pronounced Milosh Forman before, and I'm pretty sure it was on a commentary for like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, so I'm gonna go with Milosh. So directed by Milosh Forman, who also did Amadeus, which I know is a
Big hit with
favorite.
us, yeah.
and it's well, I mean, it's there's no, there's not much. You can't really summarize it beyond what it is. It's a biography of the, or a biopic, whatever you want to call it, of the career of Andy Kaufman, who, or Kaufman, but he was a, not a comedian.
Well,
He
he
was a
wasn't. He
performance
let's get this
artist.
straight. Let's all pedantry aside, right? He was a comedian, but if he doesn't want to be called a comedian, you never know how seriously to take Andy Kaufman. First of all, is the first thing I would say, and secondly, the annals of history will definitely have him in the category of comedian. He tried to make people laugh or annoy them, but that is often one and the same. So you can call him a
Basically,
comedian, but he was a performer or whatever you want.
and Andy Kaufman was the one of the first popular trolls before the internet came along,
He's the
where he was.
original alternative comedy piss artist.
Yeah, and he basically made a career out of just winding people up and pissing them off.
Yeah. Before there was Sacha Baron Cohen, and before there was Jackass, and before kind of all of alternative comedy can trace elements of it back to Andy
Yeah,
Kaufman's
definitely
shtick.
American alternative comedy owes a lot to Andy Kaufman, and he got big in the mid to late 70s when he was cast as Latka on Taxi. Where they took his foreign man character and turned it into a recurring character in the show. But then he went on to have his own specials. And he basically, like, he played pranks on everyone. He got involved in wrestling and had a feud with
Well, the
Jerry
film will cover
Lawler.
this, won't he? I mean,
Yeah,
we'll get
but
talking about that, but it's about his
and
career.
then yeah, and then he ended up dying of cancer at the age
Spoilers.
at the age of 35.
Oh.
Like, he was 35
Oh.
years old when he died. But and also, and this will probably come up, but there is quite a following of conspiracy theorists who believe that Andy is still alive out there somewhere and that his death was his ultimate prank.
Well, he was an Elvis fan, and Elvis is still out there, so.
Probably not true. He probably is dead, but
What,
it's nice.
Elvis or Kaufman? Because I'll have you know, Elvis is very much alive, and not just in the hearts and minds of all people who love rock and roll. He's alive, and I have met him in Vegas. There's a lot of them, but I've met the real one.
It's hard to go through the cast because it's kind of huge. Because you've got Jim Carrey as Andy Kaufman and also Tony Clifton and all of Andy Kaufman's aliases and
But you've got
other
Paul
personalities.
Giamatti as Tony Clifton occasionally as well, haven't you?
Yeah, and also he's Andy Kaufman's best friend and writer, Bob's Muda. And then you've got Danny DeVito as George Shapiro, weirdly, because George Shapiro is in it as Mr. Besserman, the guy who fires him from the nightclub at the start of the film.
Yeah, and Danny DeVito could have been in it because he features in the life of Andy Kaufman.
Yeah, because he actually knew him. Yeah. Taxi with him, but instead he's George Shapiro and is just absent from the taxi scenes. But the taxi scenes do have almost the entire original cast in them, including Christopher Lloyd. Yeah. We also have Vincent Scavelli, who was on Taxi as well.
I think, generally speaking, this first bit is just to clarify what we're talking about, because occasionally certain films have two different... Oh, Legend, which one's that again? Like, that might need clarification. There is one film, Man on the Moon, and it's not a documentary about Neil Armstrong. There are some good ones out there, but... That's it. I mean, we know. There's, like, the other
actors. This has almost everyone who liked Andy Kaufman in it, as other people. But it's also got some mainstays from Miloš Forman as well, like Vincent Scavelli and... I don't remember his name. He was in... and I was surprised when he popped up towards the end of this film. The guy putting the crystals on Andy Kaufman. And he was in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest as Cheswick.
Right. Not so much a credit as a long sentence where we still don't know who he is, but you remember him from something.
Cheswick is one of the main characters of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and also gives one of the most harrowing and depressing performances in the film. I'll clarify that I really, really like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Like, it's one of my favourite films.
That's a good one, yeah.
And Christopher Lloyd, Danny DeVito, Vincent Scavelli, all of them were in it. And they're in this.
Let's get to the meat and veg of why you was picked. Is it because you were a fan of the director, or is it because you like a Jim Carrey fan? Why did you pick this film? Or Kaufman? You could be him.
I am fascinated by Andy Kaufman, just for his dedication to being a shit. But also, this was more of a Jim Carrey thing because Jim Carrey is, for me, he's so hit and miss. Like, and, you know, he got big in the 90s for turning his face inside out and, like...
What do you mean?
Just, you know, rubber-faced...
Oh, right. He played loads of zany characters like Ace Ventura and The Mask and stuff.
I don't know if I'm alone in this, but, like, if you try and go back and watch, like, Ace Ventura as an adult... It's hard work.
It is.
It was funny when we were all adolescents. It was very zeitgeisty. He has like a million catchphrases from those films that are just not really catchphrases, just literal moments from the film. He doesn't say them necessarily millions of times, but
yeah,
they're very. But they date a little bit, I think.
But I think he went through like towards the end of the 90s. He went through a bit of a renaissance. I think his like the peak, like the nadir probably of wacky Jim Carrey was when he was the fucking Riddler in Batman Forever. And
well,
he was
that is on our first ever podcast, Jamie, before you were even with us. We did that film.
I thought you did a good job.
Well, you're wrong.
Well, we're not retconning the first one to include Jamie's opinions. I imagine we came down came down fairly like about it.
I saw what he was going for, but he just fucking spazzes about all over the film. And
well, essentially,
like, again,
you know, Jim Carrey is a polarizing comedian.
Yeah,
and actor.
But then he in the late 90s he started to move towards doing more dramatic stuff, and he did the Truman Show, and this they all came out around the same time between kind of 97 and 2000. And he's finally demonstrated that he was actually good at doing, like, he was a good actor. He actually was good. He wasn't just going to go up there and be all rubber faced and whatever. But then he went, at least in my opinion, he went too far the other way, and he started to sort of take himself too seriously.
Well, he's quite good in A Spotless Mind.
He is but I think that I know of, that's like the last serious Jim Carrey film I've seen where it wasn't too try hard.
I think the man himself wants to be part, not just a comedian and actor. He does literally do art, like he does painting and stuff. I think he errs on the side of pretentiousness occasionally. Considering he saw, like, his mainstream comedy, the successful stuff he does, is so, you know, wacky, and it's sometimes a little bit, like, childish and things, like, you know, Dumb and Dumber and whatnot, but...
Well, he's got the same problem that a bunch of people do in Hollywood, where... If you hit on something and it's really successful, and it was pretty much on you, if people start banding around words like genius and stuff like that, it just messes with your head.
Yeah, plus, he probably had a bit of this film that looks at Andy Kaufman. He probably related to him because Kaufman got, you know, typecast as Latka from Taxi, and Jim Carrey didn't want to be typecast as the Mask or Ace Ventura all his career. So he had to, you know, by doing other more serious roles, he could kind of like show his abilities. But I think he got a bit too serious or something?
I think I do think it's understandable that he went too far the other way because of, you know, like the scene in this movie where he's trying to do his Andy Kaufman performance artist stuff, and people are like, "Do Latka," and I'm pretty sure that like Jim Carrey probably got fucking sick of people going, "Hey, like a glove," at him just like in the fucking street when you know, he's buying a coffee or whatever, and he probably, you know, he went the other way. And I think like this film, and I hadn't seen this film until. Since it came out in 99 on I rented it on VHS.
What is that, Granddad? Is that the one that goes in a letterbox and you never see it again because it unspools?
from a VHS from a video shop.
A video shop.
Yeah.
Is that like Netflix IRL?
Yeah, it's a real Netflix that you go inside and it smells like carpet. And
yeah, there's a man and he's balding, but he's still got quite long hair.
And they're playing...
And he puts those little triangle things on that say they're not there, even though you could see them on the videos.
I actually forgot about that. And you go and you go and look at the covers of films that you know you're never going to watch. Yeah. But,
ones you pick up every time as well. Yeah. You go and pick it up and go, nah.
Yeah.
Here on Spoiler Filled, basically, this podcast is an excuse for us to look at all the films we didn't get to look at as a child in a video. Because we weren't old enough, but they looked compelling. Anyway, you saw it in 1999, you rewatched it now.
And I watched it then. I liked it when I watched it. And this was, 99 was when I was starting to kind of, you know, I was in my really early teens. I was starting to kind of...
On girls, winking at them at the bowling alley and then bowling a strike. That's for you, baby. I'll be back. I don't know why you'd quote Terminator in 99. Probably be The Matrix you'd quote.
Is this the point where you were actually thinking enough to engage with films?
Yeah, I was starting to get... Like, I'd always liked films, even as a little kid. Like, they always grabbed me. I always got engaged with them. And when I saw this, it was the age that I was starting to kind of understand more kind of dramatic films. And starting to kind of get, you know, story beats and, you know, how a film is structured and how it works. And this film, you know, really held my interest when I watched it. But I remember really liking Jim Carrey's performance in it versus what I had known of him at that point, you know, from Ace Ventura and whatever else. But I hadn't seen it since then. I remember it, you know, I remember it being good. So I wanted to watch it as an old man and like see if it still held up. And I think it's what held my attention then, and I think watching it now has been reaffirmed, is that this is almost it's the perfect balance of the two ends of Jim Carrey, because it's got all the kind of wacky stuff, but it's totally justified, and he does it just enough that when he does it, it's funny. And the same with the dramatic stuff in this. Like, he does it just enough that it's affecting and it works, and he never goes too far into "I'm a serious actor."
I kind of agree. I think it's because, in a sense, he is playing someone else, and the film is partly about the routines that Andy Kaufman did. So he's just mimicking them and basically, you know, recreating a lot of the famous bits and ideas that Andy Kaufman did to people on TV and live. And so this, and then some of it is bridging the story, so it's just playing Kaufman, you know, in real life, talking to people, his career path, and then also the harrowing, like, getting cancer, dying stuff is there to be really, oh my god, like, this is heartbreaking. So he's got a nice balance of things he has to do. So he's the comedy characters, the real man, and the kind of unknown, sadder parts of Andy Kaufman as well. So there's like almost three roles he's doing. And then yeah. You know, Andy Kaufman also does impressions or whatever of other people. So you have to be quite versatile. So it's a very good piece to have in back catalog,
I think it really does showcase that Jim Carrey is talented beyond just being kind of wacky and elasticy.
Yeah. Mm.
And also, he got acclaim for it. He was, and I think he's a pretty good. If you put them side by side, you go, well, he looks a bit lankier and a bit, he has a different, there's more facial expressions to Jim Carrey's performance as Kaufman, whereas the real Kaufman was a bit more, I think, charismatic, and a little subtler.
But, I agree with that.
Close, though, isn't he? He's a pretty good representation.
It's probably the closest you're going to get, and, like, you've got, because with this film, I think there is, if you watch clips of Andy Kaufman doing the stuff that happens in this film, it almost seems more like he comes across as a little bit more innocent than Jim Carrey's version of him does.
Well,
Jim Carrey's version is, he almost has an edge to him, but I think that's, I think that's on purpose. Cause I think in setting up to make the film, I think they were trying to look into or give an impression of how he felt rather than just have Jim Carrey, you know, go, right, just copy Andy Kaufman and we'll make a film out of it. Like, he tried to actually tap into what seemed to be like a lifelong identity crisis that Andy Kaufman was living with.
Well, we can get into the psychology as we go on. I'd quite quickly like to ask to get some context for Abby. What did you know about Andy Kaufman and all this film? Had you seen it before, etc.?
I had seen a few episodes of Taxi.
What do you like? Do you like Taxi? It's quite a mainstream sitcom. We watched one very recently, didn't we, with your brother? So we're pretty fresh on one episode.
For a formula sitcom, it's quite strong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, like, in the scope of television now, it's not as high as it used to be.
Yeah, it's not a bad comedy. It's just, you know, it is a bit mainstream. It's a little dated now.
Yeah.
Okay, so, you know, you'd seen a bit of Taxi, but really not much information on the topic of the film.
Yeah.
Okay.
Before I forget, the guy you're trying to think of, Jamie, was Sidney Lassick.
Oh. That was the man who put the crystals on Jim Carrey at the end, you said.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I wanted to tell you that before I forgot entirely.
The reason it was stuck out is because he's been in so few films and TV shows. I think he's in the X-Files at some point, but he doesn't crop up very often.
Is he the exact same character but an alien?
I think that may just be him in real life, that he is actually from another planet. He comes across as very quiet and a little bit odd.
Okay. Well,
but this movie.
Jim Carrey, what's your, you know, how do you feel about him? Do you love him, hate him, indifferent?
I knew this movie existed, but because I didn't particularly latch on to Andy Kaufman in the limited viewings that I had, it didn't particularly interest me. And I'm a little bit more sympathetic towards Jim Carrey than what Jamie described, but I am aware that there's patchiness across his career. So to have Jimmy Carrey playing a man who played a character I didn't particularly care for wasn't exactly intriguing.
Okay, so a little bit apprehensive, but not actually that prejudiced towards Jim Carrey.
No.
Because he's divisive, but some people really love him. And I think he's a very talented comedian. You could put him in a lot of different categories with various other stand-ups or comedy actors. But actually, I would say, he's obviously, he's his own man. he can do funny, he can do serious, and he's, you know, like anyone who acts long enough, there's going to be some bad films in there. I don't have any strong feelings towards Jim Carrey. I never look forward nor cringe away from him. I always just take each on a case-by-case basis, each film he's in, and so I find him a little bit grating when he's talking earnestly about his career, because I don't know. Because occasionally he'll try and be funny, and it's like, oh, yay. And then other times he'll be a bit serious. He'll be like, this is odd. You don't give me that crying clown shit. Like, I'm sad on the inside. I just want attention. But I'm also, like, you know, there's loads. Anyway, I'm just, you know, never mind. I started off saying I don't really care one way or the other, and then I started laying into him, so I take it back.
You started caring.
I started caring. I was like, I think I just watched an interview recently. I was like, oh, you knob. Not in a, you're not funny, but just in a,
Shut up.
Like, your life's sad because you're a big, successful actor and comedian, and you've got all your hopes and dreams coming true. Got too much money to be sad, mate. Shut up. it's my jealousy. I think that's it. I'm jealous of his money. You can't be sad if you've got tons of money and you've been in loads of movies. So obviously, my prejudices aside, the other side of it, I guess, Andy Kaufman. I'm a big stand-up comedy fan, old and new, all different kinds, and I'm a big fan of alternative comedy. I'm not one of these people who are like, oh, alternative comedy. Yeah, that's comedy that isn't funny. That's how it's alternative. It's the alternative to comedy. Ha ha, or whatever. I like all kinds. And I hadn't seen much of his actual stand-up because, you know, he was dead before I was born.
Weird thought.
Yeah. But, like, I didn't know. I hadn't seen any of his stuff in context. I would be too young for many years to come across it. So I guess this film must have pointed me in the direction of him a bit, which I think spoils a little bit. I watched a bit of Andy Kaufman after watching the film to see what it was actually like to see his specials and stuff. And I think he was a bit more charming than the antagonistic version that Jim Carrey portrays. But I knew his place in comedy. I knew he was key to alternative comedy. I knew he was a, like, kind of one of the first comedians to go, you know what, you don't have to do jokes, you can fucking do whatever you want, and kind of fuck with people. And that's his gift to comedy, that you could see has influenced so many different people, whether they kind of know it or not. He's gifted them, comedy can be almost anything you want. You don't have to be joke, goodbye, thanks, see you again next week. So I was aware of him. I kind of like Andy Kaufman more from watching his material than I do from watching this film. Because in the film you go, you're a fucking dickhead, mate.
Yeah,
like, that's, pranking that's... people is... You either love people who are doing pranks or you think you're a bit of a knobhead. And I think the film suggests he was a man after antagonising people as much as making them laugh. If not, he was probably more into fucking with people and surprising them than he was making them laugh. But then the film also kind of presents it like he was just coping with a weird television mental problem where he just constantly wanted to reenact television from childhood through his life when he was actually on television. He just wanted to, you know, spit out things he'd seen in a way, you know?
Getting into... that takes me into my only real sort of heavy criticism of this film. Because for the most part, I do enjoy it, but it does... You're right that it does make him seem more antagonistic than he appears when you watch him in clips and stuff. But again, like, I think that hurts having sympathy for him in the film. But at the same time, I don't know if that was actually an attempt to put on screen other people's experiences of him. Like, it's sometimes frustrating to watch him in the film, or to watch Jim Carrey as him in the film, because he borders at times on unlikable. Yeah. But at the same time, I admire the fact that the film is doing that instead of just being like a hero worship.
Yeah, of course.
Look how much of a wonderful genius this person was.
Yeah.
You know, it's putting it in front of you as you know, yeah, this guy was funny and he was a trailblazer, but at the same time, there were consequences for the things that he did, and it didn't sit with everyone 100%.
Yeah. Well, there's two elements to his annoyingness, right? So one is some of his characters and bits are deliberately to create tension, uncomfortable, that people don't know what's happening. Maybe if you haven't seen the film and you're coming to it new, you don't know what's going on. Anyway, what I'm saying is he deliberately tried to make people uncomfortable. He had fun with tension and deliberately tried to fuck with people. So that could be annoying. And he also did an annoying, like his Latka character, his foreign guy character, is my, you know, kind of annoying. Like, isn't it? Like, it's kind of it's not any one particular place. It's a bit squeaky and like it talks quite slowly. And
hold on, not from. I think you'll find he's from Kaspar. It is in the Caspian Sea. It sunk.
Yes. I can't see how that would be annoying. No, but like, I'm just putting out there that actually one of his biggest successful characters is polarizing. I personally think I'm all right with it. I think if you go back, if you bring into the, you know, credit for sometimes.
I think the issue with the character of the foreign man who became Latka is that when you watch Taxi, Latka is one of the most likable characters in it. Like he was really funny on the show, and it kind of hurts to know how much he hated it.
Well, yeah, it is. Like, but then you know, here's the second point of the film. Okay, so Andy Kaufman had a different, like the film says, basically he didn't want to do Taxi. It was to get him money and the ability to do other work that he was more interested in.
Yeah.
He didn't like doing sitcoms. Like, and he could have had a much more successful career if he'd have, you know, just been a character on TV and on the stage, and then had played ball with producers and made them understand, like, he could have come in and gone, "Hello, I'm Andy Kaufman. This is me doing the character, example. And then this is me talking to you as I have..." Like, if he could have done business like a normal person, rather than trying to prank people constantly and turning up with prostitutes as new characters on the set of Taxi and freaking out Danny DeVito and stuff.
I think this is one of, at least the way the film presents it, is it does come across in the film, and it makes sense, at least in, as far as what I know about Andy Kaufman, that the reason he was like he was is that he never really had a stable idea of himself as a person. Like, he didn't have a defined kind of self-identity. Mm. And I think that translated into his career, because he was given the opportunity with Taxi, but he didn't know, I don't think, and this again, this is just gleaned from the film, I don't know for sure, but he didn't really know what he wanted other than to be the biggest star in the world. Like, it's when George Shapiro in the film asks him, you know, that's pretty lofty, like, what do you do? And he's like, I'm a song and dance man. Like, he doesn't really have a clear idea of who he is or what he does, so he just tries to do everything.
And he can't relax into a normal person at any point, because he, like, it suggests from childhood, and Kaufman confirmed it in interviews, that he used to watch TV, presumably, he didn't just guess what was on TV, but he would then spend, you know, 4 hours a day in his rooms staring at the wall, pretending to be television and doing all kinds of shows he'd watch and just pretending, playing television on his own, and then, you know, eventually having to do it in front of his sister to appease his parents worrying about him. So he had to have at least one audience member, and that was his, you know, they show it in the film that he gets his sister in to watch him do it, and then he even says in interviews that he did it to on his own in school, and then eventually kids would just flock around him and watch him. So from a young age, he's just digested television and regurgitated it for his own playtime, and he extended that into his career, and then he got on television, and it kind of suggests, that Andy Kaufman couldn't ever be a normal person because he didn't have a personality to fall back on when he was in his downtime. Yeah. And I, you know, and here's something you have to question, and this is one of the big points. The film is kind of lying at times. It gets it wrong. It covers its ass early on because, like, Jim Carrey comes on doing, like, the foreign man character, pretending to, mm-hmm. you know, he does it doing the voice, and he's kind of saying, look, this is going to be a crap film. Let's run the credits straight away, like, and all this. Like, and they do some good comedy, but they also say some of this is jiggled about time-wise and, like, changed to be more filmically interesting. And I think they want to print the legend, and they're also looking to... Part of Kaufman's thing is, if he's trying to prank people and fool people, it makes sense that his biography should be a bit wrong and a bit incorrect.
Yeah.
And printing the myth of this maniac who could never, you know, be serious.
I think there was another way to do this film that this version doesn't do. And it's to try and make it as if Andy Kaufman himself had made it, and to make it more bizarre and, like...
Well, he'd get bored of his own biography and do something new.
Do you know what? That's actually something that I was going to bring up later on, but he died of lung cancer when he was 35. But there's this contingent of fans who believe that it was a prank and that he's still out there somewhere. And from reading and watching stuff like of him and this film, I don't think he would have the self-control to stay out of the spotlight for as long as it's now been since he died.
Sure. Well, like, this would have been the perfect place for him to cameo as an old man. And then, like, they should have had either the real Andy Kaufman, because he's alive and well, and he's in the film as, like, a background, like, just a janitor doing some mopping. And if you stop on it, you go, God, he looks a lot like how Andy Kaufman would look now.
No, it would have been perfect if he played his own dad.
Yeah. Would have, wouldn't it? Like, but they didn't credit him as that, so they can keep the myth alive.
There is a nice bit at the... we've talked about Andy Kaufman himself, we've talked about Latko, we should talk about Tony Clifton.
Right.
Because I think Tony Clifton would maybe be divisive, but I, for whatever reason, find the character hilarious, and he's actually my favourite of Andy Kaufman's, like, personas.
The only way I can think to describe him as a character is if... I said his name earlier. Rich, help me.
I don't know, a lounge singer character.
No,
so,
well, drunk, disorderly.
Oh, Johnny Vegas.
Like, if Johnny Vegas was a New York lounge singer.
Well, Johnny Vegas' concept is the same almost as... Tony Clifton, different location.
Your audience,
yeah, because Johnny Vegas is a singer. I don't know how much influence he took, if any, but his Johnny Vegas's concept is, well, I'm a all round entertainer. He likes to sing and he likes to entertain people. He doesn't really have a routine and jokes. So Johnny Vegas is a lot like him. There's so much of Andy Kaufman you can trace into actual current stand-ups as well. Like, there's an endless list of people, and you're right. It is like the Johnny Vegas of the 70s in America.
Yeah.
You like him a lot, Jamie. I think, Abby, you surprised me, because you said after the film, that was one of, even though it's the most agitating character, in a sense, in the film, you liked it more than even, like, I thought when he was, like, playing a wrestler, you'd really get that, because you like wrestling, so...
I think it's because Tony Clifton is the more accessible.
Right.
You recognise that douche as something you've seen.
And you don't recognise the classic heel that Kaufman played as a wrestler.
I think if you're not familiar with wrestling, that would just come across as obnoxious.
But Abby is very familiar. Like,
My problem with his wrestling persona
You're a woman and you don't understand it.
No, but it's like, by then it's his shtick. He's going to annoy people. That's what he does. That's my problem with Andy Kaufman is I don't like his shtick.
But you would be the perfect woman to win $500 by having a wrestling match with him, pinning him to the ground. So, like, you don't like the fact that he's trying to antagonize people, but you must appreciate, like... He basically was in love with wrestling as a person, and he wanted to be, like... Buddy Rogers, like, he loved Buddy Rogers. He wanted to do a kind of heel persona. And and wrestling is a different kind of, like, entertainment where you trick people into hating you or loving you. And
but then
you, you know...
He was also in that era where it was all cheap heat. Maybe it's just like, oh, you people smell and all this and you're stupid.
And the fact that this was an era when they tried to maintain outside of wrestling that it was genuine.
Yeah, you know, the 70s, it was, also that's part of the part of his career that went a bit wrong. Let's talk about that element for a moment before we go back to Tony Clifton. Because essentially the film just plots out the various big moments of Kaufman's, you know, career. Mm. And gives us a sense of why he did what he did and who he was. So, like, you know, he has several big characters. I guess we'll just chat about a few of them and see what else in the film intrigued us. But so this wrestling idea, he came up with the idea that he wanted to be a wrestler and that he could wrestle women and that would get him over as a bad guy, as a heel. And at live shows, he would challenge women. He would start by, you know, building in the idea that he would slag off women and that their place is at the kitchen sink and their only good points are like cleaning potatoes and washing dishes. And then he would challenge a woman to wrestle him because he thought he could, you know, I could beat a woman. There was also a slight implication that he got his sexual kicks from it. And I can understand that. He definitely enjoyed fighting women for more than just the comedy of it. But
well, that's it. Whenever it shows him with those two prostitutes, he is basically wrestling with them.
Yeah,
like he throws them around. Yeah,
and his girlfriend also implies that he was aroused fighting her. So it sort of suggests that, doesn't it?
Yeah, but, I do, you know, like the idea that he met his lifelong partner by basically beating her with wrestling moves on live TV, and then asking her out on a date.
Yeah,
and then pretending to marry her.
Did he also? I'm not sure if this. I only this time round. I watched it the first time ages ago, but now this time I noticed they went to the cinema, bought tickets, and then he bought popcorn with butter, and then they came out straight away with the popcorn.
they didn't even see the film.
So I like, but also I'm not even sure that part of his biography is true. I don't think that is how they met. They met on like a talk show or after a talk show. I don't know. Like that's part of the thing is you're unpicking the truth of his story sometimes because some of it's wrong or changed for dramatic effect. But, you know, he would wrestle women. The idea is if he fought men, he wouldn't win, so he wouldn't become this great heel. I think he wanted to take, in a sense, wrestling to the stand-up stage on television. And he just wanted to play wrestler like he did all the other TV personas. Yeah. And he totally got it, and that's why Jerry the King Lawler, who obviously understood where he was coming from as well, starts off hating him, and it's all very as if it's real. Jerry Lawler starts a feud with him, and it's exactly what would happen if it was just a wrestling medium, but he's doing it on like Letterman and stuff.
Yeah.
So he did this weird like prank on the world by coming across like he was a deluded Hollywood star, but using classic tropes of actual wrestling bad guys.
Yeah. I thought it was great.
Yeah.
It did lead to one of my favourite, really simple, but to me really funny jokes of the entire film is where Danny DeVito's George Shapiro has like sat Andy down and telling him, you know, Saturday Night Live, you've been voted off by the public of Saturday Night Live. And then he says, I don't think you two should ever work together again. And you assume that it's his friend and writer Bob, and then it cuts back and it's Jerry Law.
Yeah.
And I don't know why, but that just threw me and I found it hilarious.
It's a really good reveal.
Yeah, and it's the idea that these two, like Jerry Law and Andy Kaufman, they're just playing with each other and they've like caused trouble and have had to be told off by George Shapiro.
But, Abby, would you have been one of those votes on Saturday Night Live going, I don't want to see Andy Kaufman on the show, I'm sick of him challenging women to wrestle and calling us all fools.
Rich and I call Jerry the King Lawler King Acorn because he is the colour and complexion of an acorn.
He was a little hat on as well. Yeah. King Acorn, Jerry Lawler, the king of Memphis wrestling.
If my attitude to King Acorn would have been the same then as it is now, I would have wanted it off TV because of him rather than anybody.
See, it's your connection to modern wrestling that means you can't have enjoyed Andy Kaufman being one of the best foes Jerry Lawler ever had. Like, because Jerry Lawler is an obnoxious, often annoying commentator. He had his heyday and stuff, and he was even, like, you've got to give it to him. Jerry Lawler did a good job of being a heel because you hated him. I mean, you're supposed to hate him when he wrestled, and now he's a commentator, he's agitating, you know?
Mm.
And there was a bit of a weird time where he had, had an actual heart attack on TV and everyone felt sorry for him. So he turned babyface overnight after having a heart attack. I was like, we like you now, even though you're misogynistic and horrible. So you're coloured by disliking the wrestler he had a feud with.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, that's interesting that Jerry Lawler got to play himself younger in this biopic. Yeah. It was a good move. And also featured Jim Ross playing the commentator as well.
I'd totally forgotten about that. And I was so happy when I saw good old JR at ringside. But like, I think what I liked, the only issue I had with the whole wrestling segment of this was, I think it's, and I don't know if this is because of the way wrestling was seen at the time, but there was a really jarring moment where George Shapiro is trying to tell Andy not to wrestle Jerry Lawler, and he's like, he's the king of Memphis wrestling, like he'll tear you in half, and it's like, does George Shapiro not know that wrestling is fake?
Yeah.
Because you'd think of all people, he would be 100% aware. And then I was like, is the film trying to not reveal the secret of, professional wrestling being staged in 1999?
It depends as well. Because I'm not sure how many people were aware that Kaufman and Lawler were actually in league with each other in
That's
a positive
the other thing
way.
As well. Yeah, what, like, was it like he's actually going to fight you and destroy you in the?
Well, this is
like
the concept of the prank. If you are unsuccessfully pranked and you don't, you might be like, well, wrestling isn't that real, but you could get if male wrestlers, or even if women wrestlers, even, but if wrestlers get annoyed because you're mocking their business, and they do get, like, genuinely, any era of time, if you mock the business of wrestling and you don't secretly love it, you're going to offend wrestlers, and they could actually hurt you if you decided to step in the ring.
Yeah.
And you know, so it could have been this manager was worried that Jerry Lawler wasn't in on it and genuinely got miffed, and that Kaufman was making a mockery. But because it was a work, as they would say in the wrestling business, you know, and Jerry Lawler was in on it, they both were teaming up to tell the story and move wrestling out of the medium of wrestling, but into a kind of ambiguous real world, also onto other TV mediums. So they were trying to get away with a wrestling prank on everyone and broaden horizons. And it was because he loved wrestling that he did it, and it was kind of funny when it can't go anywhere because people genuinely hated him for doing it. So it had to end prematurely before the feud culminated.
It's interesting how ahead of his time in the way he thought of professional wrestling he was.
Yeah.
That he liked it as a performance art rather than... And it, like, I would almost say that, like, Andy Kaufman's influence really came into play in, like, the late 90s when the whole Attitude Era thing happened. And you had, like, now when I think about it, Goldust is the Andy Kaufman of, like, late 90s WWF. Like, he is that, you know, he's there to piss off the fans, and that's all he did.
The reason I was annoyed or agitated by Andy Kaufman was because, even though he was doing the old school stuff that, okay, so if you're familiar with wrestling, it's very much cheap heat, as Abby said, and it's turning up to somewhere and making fun of the locals and wearing their opposing basketball team jersey or saying they all smell and you're fat, get out of my ring, you know, like basically saying the fans are idiots and hicks and smelly and stuff. And what I thought was good about Kaufman was his whole shtick with the soap and showing them how to use a soap and it's said. I thought that was good, a good comedy bit.
I
enjoyed it.
What I liked about it, and I think the reason that I like what he did with wrestling, and I like the way it's done in the film, is you see him watching it, and before he actually gets into it, and he talks about how he would love to be a wrestling villain. And I was just sitting there watching it, and I thought, yeah, me too. Yeah. Like, if I, by some miracle, ever had become a professional wrestler, I would never want to be anything other than the bad guy, because that is the most fun you can have. But I do think it's interesting that Jerry Lawler apparently had a harder time getting on with Jim Carrey than he ever did with Andy Kaufman.
Jim Carrey went a bit method, didn't he?
Oh, he refused to be addressed as anything other than Andy. In in real life and during filming. Like, he went full-on method.
Well, you know, wrestlers have to talk to each other in the ring, and they could potentially call each other by their real names if they, you know, need to say what move to do next or whatever. Like,
and allegedly, when Jerry Lawler struck in the movie, when he struck him on Letterman, was it?
Yeah.
He actually fucking hit him.
Other than he hit Andy Kaufman.
Well, what's great about it, I think it's a moment of genius. For Andy Kaufman, as the real man who did it initially, he got to be a wrestling villain without having to train as a wrestler. And he did it by, you know, fighting women, portraying the best bad guy ever. He got to, like, he had the best of every scenario. So he got to fondle aggressively strange women who hated him, which is kind of this bizarre, like, thing that must have been vaguely arousing. But he got to be the best bad guy ever. He didn't have to do any training. He didn't have to get in shape. And then he did one of the greatest feuds with a very famous and successful wrestler. And it got to prank the world while doing it. And he translated the idea of wrestling to a broader scale. And it's kind of, it's kind
of
amazing how much...
I don't like him because he's a jammy cunt.
He got to be a bad guy without training. He got to fondle women. Yeah. He got to piss off the world. And then, like, you know, it was to a detriment to an extent, but it was still a great comedy idea. Even if people were like, oh, we hate you now, for real, because we're a bit unsure if wrestling, if this is real or not, because is wrestling real? It was the 70s, we're not sure. Hulk Hogan hasn't even, you know, become Hulk Hogan at this point, so the world isn't as tuned in to the wrestling being fake, so, you know.
I want to bring up as well, because she's introduced at this point, Courtney Love.
Yeah, that's weird, isn't it?
Do you know what? I don't know, like, as far as I know, she hasn't done a lot of film. Like, she's been in some things, but, yeah, I don't know if this is the biggest or one of the biggest things that Courtney Love has been in, but I haven't seen her in much, and I've forgotten she was in it. I don't know if I even knew who she was when I first watched it.
Well, you know, she's the lead singer of Hole, and she was the Hole of Kurt Cobain, and... I'm sorry.
That might be why she...
She apparently, and I don't know this is true, but she apparently isn't a particularly likable person in real life.
She does definitely have a reputation, and she's had a lot of, like, issues with, you know, everything. Various addictions and problems like that. And I think because, like, partly because of the scene she came from, because she was part of the whole, like, Seattle alternative rock thing in the early 90s, and she also, I think, briefly went out with Billy Corgan, and that would fuck anyone up. But
you know, she hands in a pretty reasonable girlfriend performance.
That's
like, there's no real problems.
She popped up, and at first I was like, "That's Courtney Love." I don't remember this. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of thought, "Oh Christ, that's Courtney Love," and like braced myself. Mm-hmm. But no, I actually think she's really good in this, and I think she really. She comes across in this as far more sympathetic than I think she does anywhere else. Like, she gives a really, earnest and, like, kind of at times quite raw performance. Like, and I felt really bad for her during the wrestling thing when Andy took her to Memphis to get married and then just pranked her with this, like, set. That, and she was like, "Don't ever use me as a prop like that again." And I thought, yeah, she's right. Yeah.
I'm only speculating, obviously, but there was probably some empathy there in it for her because she was in a relationship with quite a volatile person before.
Yeah, she's definitely, familiar with the kind of darker side of fame.
Mm.
And being a big name and being involved with somebody who's a big name. But no, I was pleasantly surprised, and I think it's almost it's a shame that she hasn't really done any acting for the most part. Again, I don't know. Maybe she's been in stuff since, but I haven't seen her in anything. And
it's certainly something she could be proud of, because all of us jerks who hate her go, "Oh, you're all right in that."
Yeah, I know. It sounds so patronizing. Yeah.
You're right. We were a little bit surprised to go, "Oh, that's Courtney Love. That's a bit odd." And, "Oh, she's good. That surprises me." But, you know.
It was a strange bit of casting, because it would almost come across as, like, stunt casting.
Well, let's talk about some of the casting, because we've banged on about wrestling, as we often do, even on podcasts that aren't about wrestling. So let's go... Sorry, Abby, go on.
Well, there's that very confusing thing. We mentioned earlier that a lot of the cast of Taxi are in it as the cast of Taxi, despite being entirely the wrong age.
Yeah, they're all just too old and look wrong.
I don't know. I was happy to see Christopher Lloyd in there. Like,
yeah, triple denim. Lovely.
Yeah.
But Danny DeVito, who was in Taxi, wasn't in the Taxi bit because he was playing a completely different character in... in
George Nero. Yeah. He looks nothing like him in real life.
I think it's strange.
I think it was because DeVito is... Well, I would imagine, after One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, him and Milos Forman just like working together. Yeah. But also, and I'm just like pure speculation, but it seems like Danny DeVito had... Because, he worked with Andy Kaufman a lot in Taxi, and I would presume by his casting in this film and his performance... he might have actually been one of the people who was closest to him, at least during that period.
Well, he was a colleague, and he was one of the participants, I guess, he was one of the people to be pranked by, Andy Kaufman, when he sort of tried to keep it a secret that he was also Tony Clifton. So a lot of people knew within the production of Taxi that Tony Clifton was Andy Kaufman, but a lot of people weren't in on that information.
Yeah.
And so when he turns up, late to, script readings and stuff, and he has prostitutes and stuff that happened in the film really did happen, and Danny DeVito was on the end of that trying to... Like, he experienced Kaufman. I think anyone who appears who was in Kaufman's life is basically approving of Andy Kaufman and his character and who he was.
Yeah.
And want to contribute to a biopic of him. And so I think anyone who's in it probably did it because either they're desperate for money or because they liked who Kaufman was. So it's just a bit strange to fuck up the story by having some people play themselves and some people play...
Again, you've got Vincent Scavelli as the network head, who was also in Taxi as Latka's. I think he was a priest from the same country as Latka, so they knew each other or something. But yeah, he got a major role because he's been in. Oh, he was in Amadeus too, wasn't he?
Hmm.
And I think he and Milos Forman just like working together, and also. I think people would just cast Vincent Scavelli as characters because he was the only person on Earth who looked like himself.
Yeah.
Like this strange, melted-looking man who, I need this funny-looking guy in this role.
Mm. What's the name of the guy who did the illustrations for a lot of Roald Dahl's books?
Abby, don't test me on stuff like this. I know him, but I can't remember off the top of my
head.
It's Quentin Blake.
Yeah. He looks like he drew him.
Yes, he did.
Actually, the whole thing with Taxi, they kind of gloss over it with a montage of him playing some of his famous... Like, Jim Carrey does a bunch of his famous moments, and they're very brief. And we see a little bit of what it's like to be working on Taxi and stuff. But that's just, that's just glossed over because Andy Kaufman wasn't that interested, supposedly, in doing it. And he was more interested in his odd approach to comedy, which was to come on stage and either play a record and freak people out and mime to it and do these odd, uncomfortable acts where you don't know what he's doing, you don't know when he's having a real breakdown or if he's faking it. And he's just this surreal, odd bloke who kind of performs stunts on audiences. And it was more telling us about who he was and why he did it.
Yeah, I think the reasons, like Taxi and then the wrestling thing, I will say, I like the Taxi montage just because I thought Jim Carrey's impression of Latka in Taxi was really good.
Yeah.
Mm. And also it was done to the theme tune of Taxi, which is one of my favourite TV theme tunes ever.
So jolly it's so, and odd.
It's so relaxing.
Oh yeah.
But there's that. And there's also the montage of all the women getting into the ring with him, which I thought was fucking hilarious. Just see this women just like jump in with their like early 80s housewife dresses on, leaping over the top rope and screaming at him. Like,
and also the fact that the referee is slightly cheating with him so that he doesn't genuinely get pinned a lot of the time.
Yeah, the ref is his friend Bob again.
And also, like Kaufman and Jim Carrey playing Kaufman, they both understood how wrestling works. If you're the bad guy, you constantly cheat and bend the rules and wind everyone up. And that's... Well, he was a wind-up merchant in almost every act he did. Because some of what he wanted wasn't to make you laugh, but to annoy you.
Yeah, I think what... I think after the film and after Jerry Lawler got frustrated working with Jim Carrey, Jim Carrey ended up, once filming was done and he was Jim Carrey again, he was no longer Andy. I think he sent Jerry Lawler something, and I don't remember what it was. But it was basically an apology and talking about like how big a fan he was. Sure. And I do think it's interesting that like performers like Andy Kaufman and Jim Carrey and a lot of other actors, a lot of Hollywood seems to really enjoy professional wrestling because I think there's this appreciation of the performance of it.
Mm. Yeah.
That's great, right?
I think the public generally don't or didn't get and still don't a lot of the time. It's almost like it's a performer's sport rather than a regular joke.
Let's start. We can't.
Nothing to do with anything.
No.
But I do want to say that one of the best dreams I ever had was I took Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen to go and see some wrestling, and they had the best time.
People, look, wrestling is amazing, but we're not here to talk about it outside of the... Look. All wrestling is the carny version of Hollywood. They have exactly the same thing as Hollywood.
It's Hollywood Panto.
Yeah, it's Hollywood Panto. That's it. Let's stop talking about the wrestling because we need to talk about some of the other characters and other moments of the films. Like, we haven't talked about cancer or Clifton at much at all.
I was actually gonna bring up, and related to Tony Clifton, Paul Giamatti as Bob's Muda, who was great, and what I liked, and I don't know how accurate this is to the reality of it, but I really liked Paul Giamatti and Jim Carrey's relationship as Andy and Bob, because up until that point, the film, like the introduction of Tony Clifton, where he basically attacks Bob in the audience and Danny DeVito's watching it and it's like, holy shit, this guy's insane. And then like goes back and learns that it's Andy. And then Bob comes in and it reveals that they're friends. Andy is Tony Clifton and that Bob is a plant in the audience. And he's actually Andy's writer.
Because Clifton does like bully him and be obnoxious, and it's made okay in a sense, because shocking everyone, but it's made okay because he's a plant. Otherwise, it would just be a lawsuit waiting to happen.
He's not just a plant. He's his best friend, and he's his writer. And it, I don't know what their relationship was like in real life, but I like the way it's presented in this film, as they come across as two guys in their 20s who are just reveling in winding people up.
They're the jackass of their time, weren't they? They were two guys... together, trying to prank the world.
Is that up until that point in the film, it has been presenting Andy Kaufman, and I was a little bit worried watching this like as an adult again, because I'd forgotten a lot of it, that it was going to do this whole like magical like idiot savant genius thing and not present him as human.
And a man who chats and writes stuff with a guy, not just comes up when it introduces
him and Bob together, he's still odd, but he starts coming across more like a person.
He's like a comedy hipster. He's a more cutting edge comedian than everyone else. He's ahead of the curve, and this is a guy who also gets it and is in on the joke, you know.
And I like the fact that he was kind of a more normal 20-year-old. Like, he was swearing and stuff, and he takes him to that brothel and then finds out that he's there, like, every weekend as different characters. Yeah. And, like, I liked at that point how much the film humanized him, because I think there was a danger here of, like I said earlier, it being, like, a worship piece.
Yeah, well, apparently...
for Andy Kaufman.
Yeah. Apparently, in an interview or something, or on a special, like, one of the Kaufman specials I watched, the guy actually says how he met was Kaufman pretended his arm was hurting at like a luggage carousel or something and made me he made him carry his luggage as a kind of, oh, please help me, my arm hurts. And then when he got it there, he just fucked off and just, he was just like, so they met off the back of a prank. And my favourite in the film, my favourite thing that happened with him and Kaufman was when he says he's got cancer around the table with his like producer and his girlfriend and stuff, the guy's like, oh, everyone thinks he's kidding because he's a famous piss artist. And so while they're trying, well, you know, he goes, no, I've got, genuinely got cancer. And he's the first one who's like, no, that could work. Like, yeah. He thinks the joke of it being cancer. He's the only person sick enough to be like, I get it. I get your cancer, right. We can run with this as an idea.
Yeah.
And it's like a really good moment because it's like, no, I am dying.
Yeah. But we should, I guess, talk about like the cancer segment of the film, because that's another point where it was in danger of then becoming too
sad.
Well, trying too hard to be sad, and I think it doesn't.
No,
like I like that it presents Andy at that point as almost angry about what's happening to him. That you can, there's a frustration in there.
Yeah, like he wants to keep playing television and he can't because he's gonna die. In a sense, like his work, like he wants to do, like he hasn't fulfilled his career ambitions to be in Carnegie Hall and put on a big show.
But they also got over that he was kind of sorry.
Yeah, well. He
cried wolf a little bit, wasn't it?
Yeah. And again, whether or not that's real, it works well in the film because, it humanizes him. Like he doesn't come across as... The film doesn't necessarily present him as a comic genius.
No.
Like, in a lot of the film, the people calling him a genius are everyone who's experiencing it on the periphery.
Yeah.
Whereas in the film, it presents the stuff he does as really hit and miss.
And it's also, it's hard to call someone a genius and think they're great when you've fallen for their prank. And so many people didn't know he was joking at various times. So you feel a bit, oh, this guy's an asshole. Like, I'm not going to love him. Anyway, it's very hard to like Andy Kaufman once you've been tricked by him. That's all I'm saying.
Talk about how... I feel like the film tried to cover too much time and it meant that nothing got enough time.
Right.
Because they whizzed over his childhood. They just had the bit where he was talking to the wall and then the bit where he was entertaining his sister.
Every now and again, cut to his parents worrying about him at the various stages of his career.
And then they went to, like, the beginning of his career.
Yeah.
Then it all whistled to it through the rest. And I feel like I got a good overview of his career and his life.
But it's like the greatest hits, isn't it?
Yeah. I didn't really get any... I didn't get a proper sense of him.
Where did he grow up? Oh, you mean like history-wise? Because I was going to say, like getting a proper sense of him, I don't think he ever had that either.
No, but it's sort of like, so what's this film for then? Is it just like, this is what he did? It was like... Well, yeah, everyone knows what he did. They can watch it.
Well, no, I suppose it would be in a way it'd be better to direct people to his specials and his work. But it's a love letter. It's an affectionate goodbye, and we loved you to, well, not a goodbye because they couldn't say it to him. But it's everyone going, Andy Kaufman was great, and let's do him. Let's play him. I think that's what it wants to do. It doesn't want to say he was a genius. It wants to show you how many people he affected, how he was important to comedy. I think it's a love letter, not a biopic, to some extent.
I think Milos Forman... do you know what? I think this is actually in the same vein as Amadeus.
Mm.
Because it's not a critical look at someone who is lauded as a genius, but it's an attempt to look at them behind that and try and figure out what they were like. I think Amadeus, is a little more like traditionally dramatic because it's got hero and villain kind of thing.
But also, both of them are playing fast and loose with facts. So this film skips over stuff like, yes, we're going to skip the idea that he got on Saturday Night Live and come back to it and touch upon it. But it sort of misses chunks and it kind of changes his history. And so does Amadeus. It's sort of, we want the story to be dramatic and interesting.
Yeah.
So the truth doesn't matter as much.
It's probably harder with this because people still remember it.
Yeah.
Mm. I think you've touched on something there as well, that one of the problems I had with them skipping over stuff is, like, it came across as a massive problem that he wasn't on Saturday Night Live. But so far as I can tell, he hadn't been on Saturday Night Live for ages based on what they'd shown us.
I think the chronology was it was a little bit compressed, and then when the Saturday Night Live stuff comes up later, it is kind of like, I thought he didn't give a shit. Like, he hasn't been on it forever.
You didn't get a sense of... Like, often, like, you don't know where he lived, so you don't know when he bought a new house. You couldn't get an understanding of what his relationship was with his girlfriend very much. You knew that she... You kind of almost didn't understand how she could love him, because he was just this comedy guy all the time. So because we didn't get let into the real life humdrum stuff, where he's just actually a normal man, really.
Well, I think...
You can't appreciate... The timeline, it's a bit harder to understand the how hard it is for him. When he hasn't got work, is he desperate for money? So he has to tour around the country and do work he doesn't like, necessarily. He wants to be Tony Clifton. Yeah. He has to be Tony Clifton. He can afford things he can't. We don't really have a good grip of what's happening in his life.
Because you don't know if it's only been a couple of weeks or a couple of months.
Yeah. That's what I was going to say. I think this is the only other... like problem I have with this film is that if you're watching it and you don't know anything about Andy Kaufman, the issues that you would have are he comes across as kind of aggressive and a little like antagonistic, but also the film does kind of feel like all of this happens in about a year.
Yeah.
Like it doesn't feel like 1970 whatever, like six
late
until
70s to early 80s and
yeah
onwards.
It feels like about a year.
And also, they give you a sense of who he is, but they, like, so, okay, we know he's an antagonistic prankster, alternative comedian, he's got a childhood thing that has become a career where he just imitates television. And then they just throw in stuff like, but, you know, in real life, he was into meditating and transcendental meditating, and he went to resorts to do it, and was kind of into out there hippie stuff that how did he get into that? Why is he... got it in his life, you know?
Oh, what do you mean? He was the type.
but no, being a prankster has nothing to do with I see, and then I need to be having a calm in my life.
No, see, this leads up to one of my favourite things that the film does, which is the very end where it transitions to his death. Because it gets to a point where he, you know, has obviously been undergoing aggressive chemotherapy and he's, you know, he's lost all his hair. And George Shapiro visits him at home, and he's clearly, like, he's weak.
Yeah.
He's near the end.
Yeah, and you see this whole time he's been going to... Well, again, from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, I've forgotten his name again. But he's doing, like, the crystal therapy stuff and all this bollocks that doesn't work.
Yes, thank you. That's correct.
Because he has this, you know, obviously he...
he's desperate.
What's interesting is he's into... transcendental meditation. So he did do yoga in real life, and he was into, you know, this stuff, and he did meditate, and, you know, and then he and lots of people turn to holistic remedies that you maybe don't believe until you're desperate, and so then he has to come and try extra hard things. And I think you were leading to the fact that he goes to what country does he trip to?
It's the Philippines. He's talking to George about he wants to do like kids TV. Which, you know, would have, I think at that point, because he redeems himself with his Carnegie Hall show where he takes everyone out for milk and cookies. And it is like a redemption for him for having fucked with people for so long that he puts on a show that is genuinely nice.
Yeah, the Carnegie Hall show is kind of interesting because he gets to do that on a kind of, well, I'm dying, I can spend my money doing what I want. And he puts on a big variety show. He fucks with people. I mean, there's a great bit where he gets an old lady from an old TV show on and makes her dance. And it goes faster and faster until she collapses. They fake her heart attack. And then he also has more he has dancers come in and Santa fly down. And, like, it's an OTT, I'm going to do everything I've ever wanted in one show. And it's a nice moment. And then it ends with him going for the cookies.
His apology to his audience.
Yeah, it's this is what I want to give you.
Yeah, this is what I've been trying to do this whole time.
Yeah, but anyway, back to the sad death stuff.
Yeah, so at this point he's been undergoing chemo, but at the same time he's been trying out these, like, bullshit holistic medicines, because he was the kind of nutcase who would fall for stuff like that. But
he was also a desperate man as well, so...
Yeah, but what I liked is, you know, he's obviously, especially in the film... He was someone who really enjoyed the idea of tricking people, and I think was fascinated with the idea of being tricked. That's why he liked wrestling, because it was fake.
The entertainment con, isn't it?
Yeah. You know. And then he goes to the Philippines, and he goes for psychic surgery. And this was like a big deal. James Randi, I don't know if you guys know who James Randi is, but he was a magician, and then he was like he founded the James Randi Foundation, where he basically debunks anything supernatural. And he offers like $1 million prize to anyone who can prove anything.
Yes, I have heard of him. Yeah.
And he's like he's an angry old wizard. but he actually performed psychic surgery on live TV. God. I think it was a talk show or something. And he did the whole thing where he stuck his fingers in and blood came out. But he then showed how it's done.
Yeah.
So I'd seen that, and obviously psychic surgery bollocks. You can't shove your fingers in someone and pull cancer out. But Andy's going because he calls it a miracle, and he's like, this is the cure. And what I really liked, because it was so sad, and I think another film could have done this in a much more mean-spirited way, but I think the way it was done was quite understated, and his reaction was nice. But he goes for psychic surgery, and they put him on the table, and then he sees the surgeon palm the, like, whatever they are, chicken guts.
Well, the sponge with blood in and things, yeah.
Yeah, and he just kind of laughs to himself, and then it transitions to him dead in the coffin. And the idea that his last-ditch attempt turns out to be the same thing as wrestling. It's fake.
It's like, it's what he did, isn't it? It's the ultimate prank. Yeah. And the one time he wants to be saved and needs the... He's been conned into this... It's essentially a sort of pseudo-racket, isn't it? Where, people have genuine beliefs, and even the people who do it are often... They're not deliberately being mean. They're not necessarily money-grabbing. But it's a racket. It's like it's a falsehood. It's a prank. It's the last dark laugh is on him. Because at that very pivotal moment, the irony is he's being pranked in a sense. And he laughs, and then he transitions to his death. And it's a really funny and dark joke to kill him off on.
What I liked about it is that it was funny, and it is a dark joke, but it isn't spiteful.
No.
It doesn't turn it around and say, you get fucking karma, bitch. Like, it doesn't, like...
Yeah, it doesn't go, ah!
It's just him lying there going, oh, well, fucking hell.
you got me.
and I think that is a very good and very subtle... not criticism, but it sums up what he was about really well.
Fucking
but
also of cancer remedies. What are you on about?
Well, but it also captures the sadness of the fact that he died as young as he did, and there was nothing he could really do about it.
It's poignant and ironic, and it's a really good filmic thing. And then they kind of transition to his coffin. It's really horrible having him sitting diagonally in the coffin, staring, like, it's a bit, open caskets are a bit weird, and then to have a big screen behind him as like before he died, of him talking and doing a sing-along song, and all of the people like telling everyone, in the funeral, even though he doesn't, like, the video doesn't know that, but like he's telling the audience and the funeral to like sing along and like put their arms around each other and sway, and it's a little bit hokey to some extent, but you need a bit of sad happiness to cleanse the dramatic irony there, I guess.
I did think it was interesting that when he's bald, particularly the shot of him in the coffin, he looks very much like Michael Stipe of R.E.M.
Yeah, who, I noticed that as well.
The only thing that explains the bloody song. Like, the song, the title bugs me because I don't, like, I get song, maybe, okay, let's talk about it.
The song is about Andy Kaufman.
Yeah, R.E.M. I get that. R.E.M. did a song called Man on the Moon. The film is called Man on the Moon. But, so Andy Kaufman, though, is there any deeper meaning? He is a man that reached for the stars and was like, is he like the moon landing because he was a pioneer?
It's a reference to the whole moon landing hoax conspiracy.
But it wasn't a hoax.
No, I know it wasn't, but Andy Kaufman's also dead. But
he also really is dead. Yeah.
And there are people who, like, his death hoax thing falls into all those other, like, pop culture hoax ideas. And R.E.M., being the kind of band that they are, who, like, used to very much tap into kind of pop culture zeitgeist and used to write songs about things that had happened in the public consciousness, they kind of combined them together and just wrote a song, you know, years and years before this film was made. At like Automatic for the People came out in 94, I think, maybe 93. But they just put it in because it was a good song.
You've reminded me of something. Did the voice you put on for Tony Clifton make you think of the Muppets, Jamie?
Yes. This is something
what is this
that
about?
I completely forgot about. I'm glad you reminded
like
me.
Muppet as well, didn't
yeah.
he?
Yes, I'm so glad that other people thought that.
What's weird is, as Andy playing the foreign guy, he seemed like a, hello, I am... When he did that, he sounded like a kind of Muppet. And then when he did Clifton, I can't place who he sounds like. It's either... But it's very Muppety, isn't it?
Well, the thing about Tony Clifton is, it's not just the voice, it's the physical movements. Like, he moves like a fucking Muppet. Like,
his mouth flaps up and down, and his hair and the, prances
the
about like...
The whole, like yeah, the whole, like...
Yeah, it's odd, isn't it? But also, think... like, what's kind of interesting is they didn't feature, like, his puppet comedy. Like, he did a ventriloquist bit where he, like, the idea is he doesn't open his mouth, so he tries to do the voices and he can't do it. So he just mumbles all the words both puppets says. He does, like, one of the best and original I'm bad at ventriloquism acts, but I'm going to do it anyway. And I think, in a sense, it's fitting that we thought of the Muppets because he did enjoy a bit of puppetry and ventriloquism.
The other thing I wanted to say about Tony Clifton as well, and it comes into play in the last scene of the film, is that the fact that he's played at different points by both Paul Giamatti and Jim Carrey, but when they're dressed as Tony Clifton, you can't tell them apart.
Yeah, it's really hard.
Like and Paul Giamatti's like ability to impersonate Tony Clifton exactly like Jim Carrey is really, really impressive.
We assume it went that way around.
Wait, so Paul Giamatti is impersonating Tony Clifton, the original, or is he impersonating Jim Carrey? Or is Jim Carrey trying to match Paul Giamatti's version?
I will say, I think like there was a lot of buzz about this film, about Jim Carrey when it came out, and you know, deservedly so. But I think Paul Giamatti's a bit of an unsung hero in this as well.
Because he's essentially doing two roles as well.
Yeah, but not like he's really good because... The way him and Jim Carrey play off each other does lend a lot to that whole, like, young, almost like college buddies pranking people kind of relationship that they have. But at the same time, his ability to, like, become Tony Clifton like that is fantastic. But yeah, it leads to the ending of the film where George Shapiro and Courtney Love's character Lynn go see a Tony Clifton show. And presumably it's Paul Giamatti until the camera pans away and he's at the back watching it.
It was actually, so it's not that we'll talk about that, but the first thing that got me was before Andy Kaufman dies in the story in the film, he says, well, Tony Clifton can pay off my debts. And it's at no point did he look at Paul Giamatti's character and go, is that right? Do you mind working my debts off? I mean, I'm going to die, so it's not that harsh of me, but...
Yeah,
they didn't do that. They did talk about it like Tony Clifton was real. Yeah. So,
well, I'm glad that the film, like I don't know what.
I think they're just trying to say, is the myth real? But they're also going, this is what Andy Kaufman would want. He would want there to be constant fucking with people.
The last scene with like Paul Giamatti watching Tony Clifton, and he's singing "I Will Survive."
It's so funny.
I think it. It's not meant to be like a literal, but is he dead kind of thing. I think it's just, the idea of the memory of Andy Kaufman and the influence he had was so massive for someone who was so controversial that it, like, he will live on like forever in, in pop culture and like modern American culture and just comedy generally. But I do think it is a nice nod to the people who do have that whole, like, but what if he did fake his own death kind of thing.
To me, it's just signing off with a Kaufman joke again. So it's like, this is a Kaufman-style joke. We have to end with him and his approach to comedy. Yeah. And then on the actual real credits, not the fake credits like the start, Andy Kaufman as foreign guy pops his head in again.
Yeah.
And, like, that's the last thing we see, I think. So it's a fucky ending. But I think the whole time it's trying to be faithful to what the idea of Andy Kaufman's comedy was, rather than nailing the exact life story. I think that's the key to it.
Yeah, and I think for the most part, the film works in balancing the idea of him as an actual person versus the myth.
And also showing people, like, it's kind of an introduction to, as well.
That's what I think the film actually works best as, is it's not necessarily a completely in-depth biopic, and I think that could be done, but it would be difficult just because it's so difficult to pick him apart. Mm. And I think this is definitely a really good, like, you know, you stumble across information about Andy Kaufman and you're like, wow, this guy's fascinating. Mm. And then you watch this film to kind of give you a better overview of him before you start really kind of digging into who he was. Mm. But it is definitely an overview. Like, it's a, it touches. Yeah, it is. And it touches on as much as it can. Mm. And I think that does hurt it to an extent because it does, it would have benefited from at least having, and I might sound like I'm just a fucking idiot for saying this, but it would have benefited, I think, from at least having a caption every now and again telling you how much time has passed.
Yeah, just, something. Just bit of grammar.
Yeah, because the film itself doesn't give you an impression, unless you know him and when he did things.
Yeah.
I don't think you realize how much time has passed.
It kind of assumes you already know about Kaufman and you want reminding of his
that's
life.
That's another problem, but not really problem, of this film, is that it is made for him and his fans more than it is the general public. And, you know, that's, I think that's fine. I think that's a very Milos Forman thing. You know, he has made in the past, you know, Amadeus, for anyone who's not into either theatre or film, is hard work because it is a fucking long film. And for anyone who's not in the mood to watch something like that and not prepared for it, it could be a slog. And One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, by the same token, is an exhausting film.
Well, actually, Amadeus is kind of like the film. It's like a film that's trying to be a film opera. Because here we've got, okay, so you're doing Andy Kaufman's biopic. Let's make it like an Andy Kaufman bit. Yeah, all the time, exactly. We never know where we are. It pranks us, it tricks us. It's and not factually again, accurate, and it's uncomfortable. And then Amadeus is like, it's a drama of his life, but it's an operatic version of it, you know?
And then you've got One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which is very, like, almost documentary, you know, gritty, in there with the inmates kind of thing.
It's like translating whatever he wants to tell the story of. He wants to make the story feel like what he's telling it about.
And I think I'm pretty sure those are the only films I've seen of his, and I think he's a director with just a lot of artistic integrity, and he really throws himself into every film he makes.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes it's kind of regardless of whether or not it'll have popular appeal.
Yeah.
Like he's almost like I don't know. He's an old school like artist director
It's admirable. Yeah. And then sometimes you're too close to the material, so subjectively you fuck up little things like, you know, narrative. Where are we in the timeline? Anyway, I feel like what we're saying is it's a good film, but there are things that could put you off.
I don't think it's for everyone, and I don't think it is perfect. Like it does kind of skip too fast, but at the same time, it had the potential to be about 3 hours long, and I would have hated that. I'm glad it's as short as it is, because there's a lot of biopics, and again, Lord of the Rings syndrome, post-Lord of the Rings, every film is now 4 hours long. You know, had this been made in the 2000s, you know, the later 2000s, it would have probably been far worse, because it would have been long and...
Mm.
But it wasn't. I mean, no, we're in danger of going a bit long now. So let's try and nail our finale, which is basically any last bits of business, any little moments. There's loads of gems we have avoided talking about, but you know, because check out the film, guy. You know, duh.
Yeah, I think
anything else though. Abby, have you got any other thing that you were dying to mention but subsequently didn't?
No, I'm on to Metaphors.
I'm thinking, which man on the moon was it? Was it Buzz Aldrin? was it? actually, if I was to pick a man on the moon, I would pick the guy, was his name Michael something? The guy who stayed in the capsule and didn't get to actually stand on the moon.
Yeah.
And no one remembers his name, like I'm not. I feel like an arsehole because I tried to remember his name when I watched a documentary about the moon landings. But I just, and I think that guy was so important to the mission.
Yeah,
but he's forgotten. And Andy Kaufman is so important to alternative comedy, but he's often forgotten about because it was so long ago and he didn't have, you know, he lived to 35. So I think he's the third man on the first Mars mission. Listen to me.
Third man on the moon.
He was the third man on the moon who didn't technically step on the moon, but was there and integral to the story and the history, but isn't the most famous comedian. It isn't the most successful film or biography, but it's certainly, you know, significant and important and amazing.
He's not even on the fucking Wikipedia page.
The third guy?
Just mentions Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin.
Those cunts. Those fucking hammy cunts taking all the credit. We got to name drop him because I think his name is Michael.
Yeah, that's what I'm pretty sure it's Mike. It is Michael something, but fucking...
That's who I think he is. He's that man on the moon. Abby, do you have...
I didn't realise that we were going to be theming it that way.
How do you want to theme it?
Oh, yeah, no, you can... Yeah.
I was just going to say that it's a bit of a lemon cheesecake for me.
We always do food, Abby.
I'm a food-orientated person.
You're saying you're fat. You're just saying I'm a big fat lump. Because you're not.
Not
you're
at doing, all.
Anyway, Abby is doing very well. Getting health. She's not eating any lemon cheesecakes, I'll tell you that much.
Michael right, Abby,
how is it like a lemon cheesecake?
Well, it's one we've used before. It's that go-to phrase for when, like, a cheesecake is nice, a well-made cheesecake is very pleasant and you enjoy it, but because this one's got lemon in, never going to like it.
I'm never going to like it, you're never going to like it, but some people are going to love it. Like some people love it, and then some people, you know, don't like cheesecakes, and therefore it doesn't matter, like, they can't be having it. So it is that you'll either, it's good, and it is popular, it works, it's a standard, lovely dessert, but there are going to be people who just can't deal with it, either because it's the Kaufman-esque nature of it, or, you know, there's lots of reasons you could maybe not enjoy it. And I think it is kind of like lemon cheesecake, presented to you by a really obnoxious with a lounge singer coming along and putting his fag out in it after telling you you're not allowed to smoke yourself. And he comes and does that. So it's a lemon cheesecake with a fag in it, I would say. Or cigarette, if you will. Sorry to jump on your metaphor there. Jamie, do you have a moon land? Someone on the moon? Well, another food? What do you want?
I have found the third member of the mission. His name was Michael Collins.
I'm glad I remembered his first name, Michael Collins. Good job, Mike. Good job. You fucking nailed
that. Someone needs to make a biopic entirely about Michael Collins and his life.
Neil Armstrong's life is fascinating as well. But in a obviously it's fascinating. But learning about like him being a test pilot and just the ordinary side of him and the fact that fame fucked him up. Like literally everyone in the world went, we want to touch you and shake your hand and meet you. You've been on the moon. No one has been on the moon. You've been on the moon. And it's just, I'm just a bloke. I'm just a test pilot and a... Yeah. It's like fascinating, but yeah, they all have fascinating life. Every person who gets to work for NASA must have a few stories. But yeah, so do you agree with me, or do you think he's a different moon? Is he the first dog in space?
I don't know. I think yours is good. That he's
there's
like
a nursery rhyme. There's a nursery rhyme about a man on the moon, but he's got a weird. The man on the moon nursery rhyme is well weird. So maybe that suits, I don't know. Sorry, Jamie, you come up with a thing.
I was just going to compare it to Andy Kaufman's obsession in real life, his IRL obsession with chocolate cake.
Oh, yeah. Jim Carrey has a really nice-looking piece of chocolate cake as well. And I was like, God, that looks good.
This film reminds me of like a really well-done chocolate cake where it's... Like, you know, the ones that are really rich and have that, bitterness underneath them of dark chocolate. And it works really well together, but it's like somebody has given me one piece. And I can see the rest of the cake over there, and I'm like, I just want the whole thing and just to eat as much as I can.
But then you'd be sick.
But then I would be sick. And it's exactly the same thing. I think this film holds back a lot that is potentially really good, but if it gave me all of it, I would get annoyed and I would hate Andy Kaufman.
But what was Andy Kaufman famously into chocolate cake then? Or?
Yeah, chocolate cake and ice cream.
Ice cream. Oh, that's why she mentioned Haagen-Dazs. So,
yeah,
see.
He also had, and this is, I like, this isn't like a mention actually, how subtly the film addressed the fact that he was a diagnosed sufferer of obsessive compulsive disorder.
The hand swiping.
You see him cleaning his hands, you see him separating his food out and going through routines.
Yeah.
I like the fact that the film addressed it and it was there all the way through, but it never made a thing of it. Like, he just had it. Character trait.
He didn't say he was a genius because he had mental issues. It just went, look, he has little things that are in his life.
But yeah, it's like having that piece of chocolate cake that has all the right elements, but you haven't had enough. But you know, if you had as much as you actually wanted, you would be sick.
Yeah. I think the film is perfect for doing Andy Kaufman's life. It is the right way to do it. Because Andy Kaufman has elements about him, like being a bit of a dick or a prankster or like not being, sometimes he needed to be conformist, and I'm all for being alternative, but sometimes you're just fucking yourself over. And I think the part of Andy Kaufman that's like that is the fact that he believed in, like, well, he at least went along with holistic medicine. He was desperate, as I say, but he was up for that kind of like transcendental meditation. That side I find a bit wanky, and I think the film has a little bit, so I think that's a bit wanky as well. And so that's why the film is fitting, because Andy Kaufman wasn't the perfect genius. He was like a flawed, great, like comedy personality, and it all ended tragically. But so I think the film, it does what the director does, which is the film reflected what its source material was, which is a nice thing to do, I think.
Much like Andy Kaufman in real life, chocolate cake is not very good for you in large doses.
Yeah. As is lemon cheesecake, as is the third man on the moon, Michael Collins. He's terrible. First it's going to be interesting, but he's such a bore.
It's being on the moon in large doses is not good for you.
you soon run out of the novelty of being able to jump a bit higher and look for the golf balls.
I like the idea of just starting on the moon after about 20 minutes and going,
there's only a flag and that thing we came on, and it's mainly there. Dust. There's not any cheese.
It's cold.
Yeah. Where's that bloody vending machine that's supposed to be skiing on the moon?
Oh, God. Don't freak me out by making me think of Wallace and Gromit. Wallace and Gromit Begins.
Yeah. So like landing, like being on the moon for too long, it is bad for you. Which, too much of Andy Kaufman will start to hurt.
Give you diabetes.
And lack of oxygen, and you get what we're saying. It's a good film, but where we don't want to be super. We have our reservations, but it's completely justified in what it does.
It's a good beginner's guide to Andy Kaufman.
Yeah, if anything, you should check out as much of The Real Man as you can.
Yeah.
And see what you think. I think though Jim Carrey is accurate, Andy Kaufman is kind of more charming and much softer. Fit in the face, but also like physically, but also he's a much more charming and subtle, there's something likeable and charming about him, no matter what his guys. I mean, maybe not Tony Clifton, but his Elvis impersonation is very good. And
holy shit, yeah.
And
we skipped over that, but fuck, he did. It, also, in real life, IRL, once again, Elvis's favourite impersonation of him that he ever saw.
Really?
It comes, it's a good bit as well to go from impersonation, doing that kind of slow talking. It's a good gag.
Of the United States of America.
That's how I do all my impressions. Even when I try harder, I start with "I am," name of the person I'm doing.
Cuts is that out a because lot of Andy Kaufman? Or it wasn't. You do that
coincidentally, whenever I do try and imitate people occasionally, and I do go, "Hello, my name is." And say who they are, because then people are on board. It's just much easier than trying to remember catchphrases. But anyway, all that said, that brings us to the end of the podcast, right, guys?
Yes.
Time to end on a song.
Valari.
Yeah, but he doesn't really say Valari. He just goes. So I did try. Sorry for making it a bad attempt. Right, time to end the podcast. Goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you very much.